Thank you very much, Anthony, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Board of the Reserve Bank of Australia, I'd really like to offer you a warm welcome to this community dinner. Thank you for coming along and showing an interest in the Reserve Bank and for joining us this evening. I'd particularly like to welcome the Treasurer of Queensland, Curtis Pitt, and the Leader of the Opposition, Tim Nicholls. It's great to see you both here. I was saying to one of my colleagues as I walked into this room, it's the first time that I've given a speech in a sea of liquidity surrounded by bubbles. That wasn't meant to have any particular policy significance, but I thought it was quite an interesting backdrop for this evening's function. As you're probably aware, the Reserve Bank Board had its monthly board meeting here in Brisbane today at our offices on Creek Street, and it's fantastic that Queensland was able to put on really great weather for us today, and it's a privilege to be able to speak in this fantastic venue. I'd like to take the opportunity this dinner to welcome Mark Banabar to the board of the Reserve Bank. This was Mark's first board meeting, and he brings a wealth of experience in banking and the resources sector to the table. Mark replaces John Akehurst, who retired from the board just last week after a decade of public service. Over those 10 years, John made an outstanding contribution to our deliberations. It's fair to say that he served through interesting times, perhaps a little too interesting. We had a global financial crisis, the biggest investment boom in more than a century, and central banks worrying that inflation was too low, not too high. And that was all just in the past 10 years. Mark, I hope your time on the board isn't quite as interesting. At our meeting today, we had the usual review of the global and Australian economic and financial data, as well as a deep discussion of recent developments in Queensland. We know that the Queensland economy has gone through a difficult time over the past couple of years following the wind downing of the mining investment boom, and that the pain has been concentrated in some of the regional communities. We're also watching the Brisbane property market very carefully, particularly the effect on prices of the large increase in supply of apartments that's coming online. More broadly, though, a range of indicators, including employment and retail trade, suggest that there's been a recent improvement in economic conditions in Queensland. There's been a noticeable turnaround. The lower exchange rate's also helping, particularly in the tourism, education and rural industries, and this means that an appreciating exchange rate would be unhelpful from this perspective. As you've probably heard, the board decided to leave the cash rate unchanged at 1.5%. It's unlikely to have come as a surprise to many people. The cash rate's been at 1.5% since last August, and financial market pricing suggests market participants expect it to remain there for a while yet. And as usual, the reasons for our decision were released shortly after the meeting. For some time, the board has been seeking to balance the benefits of stimulatory monetary policy with the medium-term risks associated with high and rising levels of household indebtedness. It's clear that the current low level of interest rates is helping the economy in its transition. It's supporting employment growth and a return to inflation to around its average level. Encouragingly, growth in the number of Australians with jobs has picked up over recent times and the unemployment rate's come down a bit. And just recently, the investment outlook has also brightened. We've been waiting for this to occur for some time, but it now seems to be happening. Inflation has troughed, and it's likely to increase gradually over the next couple of years. And these are all positive developments for the Australian economy. Even so, it will be some time before we are what we considered full employment in Australia and before underlying inflation returns to the midpoint of our target range. And this means that stimulatory monetary policy continues to be appropriate. The board has been conscious that attempting to achieve faster progress on unemployment and inflation through yet lower interest rates would have added to the risks in household balance sheets. Lower rates would have encouraged faster growth in household borrowing and added to the medium-term risks facing our economy. Our judgment has been that it is not in the public interest to encourage an already highly indebted household sector to borrow even more. More borrowing might have helped today, but it would have come at a future cost. So the board has been prepared to be patient, and it's not sought to overly engineer or overly fine-tune things. In our view, the balance that we've struck is appropriate, and it's likely that the economy will pick up from here as the drag from declining mining investment runs its course. Our central scenario is for growth of around 3% over the next couple of years and for the unemployment rate to move gradually lower. In striking the appropriate balance, we have paid close attention to trends in household borrowing, given the already high levels of household debt. Over the past 4 years, household borrowing has increased at an average rate of 6.5% a year, while household incomes have only been growing at 3.5% a year. Given this, the Reserve Bank has worked very closely with APRA to ensure that lending practices by banks remain sound. Rightly, APRA has had a very strong focus on loan serviceability calculations. In many cases, loans were being made where the borrower had only the slimmest spare income. APRA has also introduced restrictions on growth and investor loans and on interest-only loans. In my view, this has been the right thing to do. Now, one might ask why the lenders themselves did not do more to constrain their activities in these areas, given the earlier trends were adding to risk in the overall system. When everything's going well, it appears that any single institution has trouble pulling back. Each worries about their competitive position and about the market reaction. Individual institutions are also more likely to focus on their own risks rather than the risks to the system as a whole. And this means that supervisory measures can be useful in helping the whole system pull back. Ideally, such measures would not be needed, with instead the appropriate level of restraint coming out of lenders' holistic system-wide risk assessments. But when this does not occur, supervisory measures like the ones we've seen can play a constructive role. Most lenders are now operating comfortably within the new restrictions, and these measures are not unduly restraining the supply of overall housing credit in Australia. One of the factors that it has a bearing on current discussions of household debt is the slow growth of household incomes. Over the past 4 years, nominal average hourly wages in Australia have grown at the slowest rate in many decades. This means that borrowers haven't been able to rely on rising incomes to reduce the real value of their debt repayments, and so debt service ratios are remaining higher for longer. And this is something that both the lenders and the borrowers need to take into account. The slow growth in wages is a common experience across most industrialised economies. It lies behind the sense of dissatisfaction that's being felt in many of our communities. Now, the reasons for the slow growth in wages are complex. Part of the explanation is the perception of greater competition from both globalisation and from technology. An increased sense of uncertainty amongst workers is also likely to be playing a role as is a change in the bargaining environment. The slow growth in wages is contributing to the low inflation outcomes we're seeing here and elsewhere around the world. My expectation is that this is going to continue for a while yet, given the structural factors that are at work. But I am optimistic enough that I don't see this as a permanent state of affairs. It's likely that as our economy strengthens and the demand for labour picks up, growth in wages will pick up too. After all, the laws of supply and demand still work. Even at the moment, we see some evidence through our liaison program that in those pockets where the demand for labour is stronger, wages are increasing a bit more quickly than they have for some time. And the Reserve Bank's central scenario is that over time, this will become a more general story. On another matter, over the past few months, there's been quite a lot of interest in the regular special papers considered by the Reserve Bank's board. This followed the release of the minutes in July, which recorded that the board had held a discussion on the neutral interest rate. That's the rate at which monetary policy is neither expansionary or contractionary. The main conclusion from that discussion was that in future it was likely that the average level of the cash rate would be lower than it was before the financial crisis. This reflects slower trend growth in the economy and a shift in the balance between savers and investors. When people want to save more and invest less, the return to savers is inevitably lower. These same forces are at work right around the world, so the average level of interest rates globally is likely to be lower than it was before the financial crisis. A second conclusion from our discussion was that at the moment the cash rate is around 2 percentage points below our central estimate of the neutral rate. And as we make further progress on both unemployment and inflation, we could expect the cash rate to move upwards towards the neutral rate over time. It's worth repeating that the board's considerations of these issues carries no particular message about the short-term outlook for monetary policy. The discussion was part of our regular in-depth review of important topics. As is appropriate, these discussions are reflected in our minutes. I hope that you see Australia's Central Bank as transparent, as analytical, as rational, as independent. We seek to look at issues in detail and from different perspectives and to explain our thinking to the public. While not everyone agrees with every one of our decisions, we do our best to explain those decisions and the framework that we use to make them. Now, this month's special discussion was on the Chinese economy. One focus was on the difficult trade-offs facing the Chinese authorities. There's a clear need to and a desire by the authorities to address the high and rising level of debt. At the same time, though, the authorities are committed to achieving growth targets that are still quite high. And it remains an open question as to whether both of these objectives can be achieved. Here in Australia, we have a strong interest in the Chinese authorities getting the balance right. Another focus of our discussions was the Chinese authorities' progress in implementing the structural reforms announced in 2013 at the third plenum. The one-child policy has been relaxed and the government has expanded funding for social security and healthcare. The value-added tax has been broadened and there's been some deregulation of interest rates. So there's been quite a lot of progress on a number of fronts. But at the same time, there is still some way to go to meet the stated goal of allowing market forces to play a decisive role in resource allocation. Reform of state-owned enterprises has been slower than many had hoped for, and the state, rather than the market, still has a strong influence in allocating resources in parts of the economy. As we discuss today, the pace and future of future reform in these various areas is likely to be influenced by the outcomes of the 19th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party later this year. And on one final matter, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that our new $10 note will be issued in just a couple of weeks on the 20th of September. The new note contains the same world-leading security features as the $5 note we released last year. Those include a clear top-to-bottom window and a tactile feature which can be recognised by the vision-impaired members of our community. For me personally, the new $10 note will be a particularly special one. This will be the first to have my signature on it. We've printed a couple of hundred million of these notes, so it's been a busy time for me and for John Fraser. We've been doing a lot of signing recently, but we've produced them all. They're ready to go. The new note will continue to feature Mary Gilmore and Banjo Paterson, two of Australia's most famous writers. And both of them grew up in southern New South Wales, just as I did. Indeed, Mary Gilmore spent time at schools in both Cootamundra and Wagga Wagga, just as I did as a child. Both of these writers also have a connection to Queensland. For many years, Mary Gilmore's husband ran a farm near Cloncurry in northern Queensland. And of course, Banjo Paterson is said to have written the words to Waltzing Matilda during a trip to Dagworth Station near Winton. So we're proud to have these two great Australians on our banknotes, and I hope you're looking forward to seeing them. We are. Again, thank you very much for your attendance tonight. I hope you enjoy the dinner and the conversation, and thanks for the Reserve Bank of Australia.